Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Capitol Bureau Chief Katie Meyer, filling in for Scott Lamar, who is out today. We have a lot to get into. As you probably know, it's election day, and there are lots of judicial and local political candidates on the ballots. We're going to spend the first half of the show talking about major updates counties have been making to their voting machines, plus a long-awaited overhaul to the Commonwealth's election code that was signed into law just last week. Joining me to talk about all of that is PA Post reporter Emily Previty and Doug Hill, who serves as the executive director for the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. Thanks for being here, you two.
Great to be with you.
Before we get into all of that, though, I just want to note some quickly evolving news that we've been following. Generally, on the day of the election, we don't talk about the candidates and the other things that might be on the ballot because we don't want to have undue influence on anyone's opinion. But we're making a very small exception today for Marcy's Law, which is a proposed amendment to the state constitution that aims to protect victims' rights. So you can read more about what it does on WITF and PA Post. But you may have heard that last week, the Commonwealth Court issued a preliminary injunction on Marcy's Law after the American Civil Liberties Union brought a suit saying it is unconstitutional. That means while voters can cast ballots for and against the amendment today, and counties can tabulate them unofficially, the votes won't be officially counted by the Department of State until the courts decide whether Marcy's is constitutional. Just yesterday, the state Supreme Court upheld that ruling, so for all intents and purposes, we assume that that is what is going to be happening tonight. But there's been a lot of back and forth on that, so we wanted to clarify it. And we welcome your questions and your comments on that and anything else we talk about today. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a comment or a question on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. And again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Okay, now, so Emily and Doug, thank you for waiting through that. So the Marcy's Law situation is not the only thing that's been changing kind of quickly as far as Pennsylvania's elections are concerned. So Emily, I want to start with you. There was this package of new election laws that was passed by the legislature, signed into law by the governor. It had been worked on for a long time. What's in there? What does it do?
There are many things in this bill, or this new law, Act 77, which originated as Senate Bill 421. It lets people vote by mail without an excuse. That's a big one. Right now, Pennsylvanians need to apply and provide an excuse if they want to vote absentee, like they won't be in their home municipality the entire time the polls are open due to work, attending college, being on vacation. Or they might be observing a religious holiday or serving in the military. So those are some of the acceptable excuses. But going forward, Pennsylvanians will be able to vote by mail without an excuse. It also makes the window for turning around those absentee or mailed-in ballots slightly longer.
Mm.
So right now, you have to have it back to your county elections office by close of business the Friday before the election, and going forward, you would have until 8 o'clock on election day to get it into that office, and that's when polls usually close. Doug might be able to provide a little bit more detail about this one, but basically, if your plan is to vote absentee and then decide you want to vote in person, you can do that, but you'll be casting a provisional ballot subject to review by your county election board, which is a little bit different than how it works right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, Doug, yeah, you're the kind of the go-to guy on what happens with the counties, because, you know, I think a lot of people maybe underestimate how big of a role the counties have in Election Day and on elections generally. We're a state that leaves a lot to the counties, right? So what does this do for them?
Sure, yes. Counties have the responsibility of running the entirety of the election. And so we handle registrations, we handle the absentee ballots, we develop the ballots locally, and we set the polling places and everything else relative to the conduct of the elections, something that counties are very proud to be able to do. On the particular point Emily just raised, yes, if you vote by absentee ballot and you cast the absentee ballot going forward, you will not be permitted to vote in the polling place. If you've not cast the ballot, but you've applied for it, you'll be able to vote, but it'll be a provisional ballot, and the county will have to check first to make sure you didn't actually cast the absentee before they count that provisional ballot.
All right. And Emily, so this whole package of bills just signed, when does it go into effect?
I believe it's taking effect just in time for the primary.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some more components to it that I kind of cut out in the middle of it, if you want me to go back.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
So it also gets rid of automatic straight ticket voting for a single party, which I think we're going to get into later in a bit more detail. So like right now, you can fill out a box at the top of a handwritten ballot or push a button on a touch screen, and it'll automatically fill in the candidate for that party on the entire ballot, but you won't be able to do that going forward. And that was controversial, but we're going to talk about that more later.
We will. Yeah, that's the automatic straight ticket voting thing, and we absolutely will talk about that. Anything else that you think is of note that was in that package?
So, yes, the voter registration deadline is moving from a month out to 15 days.
So you just said a month to 15 days. So people have more time to register to vote now, right? Or will have
correct.
It once this goes into effect. Yeah.
Correct. On the county's end, that cuts their time for processing in half, and there were some concerns about that.
Yeah.
We'll also get into a little bit more.
Yeah.
The new law says counties can base their ballot printing quota on the average turnout from the last three comparable elections.
Okay.
So that's looking at presidentials. For example, you look at the turnout over the last three and add, I think, 15% to that. And it will work similarly for other years, except the add-on is 10.
Yeah. And so, yeah, Doug, I want to ask you again how it works on the ground. How does that specific component, that registration change, I'm assuming, it's a lot more for you to process?
Well, it's not so much that it's a lot more to process.
More
it's
quickly.
Just it compresses the timeline, and then the timeline for processing those registrations also falls on top of what we anticipate is going to be an increased number of absentee ballots coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we'll be able to do, certainly, and the voters should have confidence that we'll be able to. It's just that the process itself requires some time. We have to assure that the individual is qualified to vote in that district. We have to add them to the database. And then more particularly, the time crunch is when they move from one voting from one district to another, one county to another, that requires a confirmations at both ends that they have moved and that they're qualified at the new place. So that does compress our timeline significantly.
Yeah. And because of that, I mean, do you guys have to bring on more staff? I mean, do counties have to bring on more staff? Is there funding for that from the state?
Well, we probably, at least the first couple times out until we get the rhythm of the thing, we'll probably have to add in some additional staff. We already do now as it is. And once we get a sense of how much voters are going to take advantage of the new absentee ballot provisions, and then also the frequency at which people register very late, it'll give us a better idea going forward what our actual staffing needs will be. But no, there's not any additional funding that's a part of that.
Did counties want additional funding?
Well, we didn't ask for it
on
this point.
You got to ask for those things.
Right. And really, because it we consider that, first off, the macro statement is we are in support of whatever we can do to help people vote more conveniently and help people better and more easily express their choices. And so we've supported this legislation.
Mm-hmm.
The 15-day provision came into the discussion very late, and candidly, we were focusing more on the funding that the legislation makes available to reimburse counties for the new election equipment that we're installing statewide.
Okay, gotcha. We're going to jump around a little bit, but we've got a call on the line from Roger in Elizabeth Township. Roger, are you there? You had a question about Marcy's Law.
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call.
No problem.
I have an elementary sort of question about voting for Marcy's Law. I'm neither a Democrat nor a Republican, but I am registered to vote in Pennsylvania. I wonder how to vote for Marcy's Law.
Sure.
Gladly hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your call. Well, this is the general election. So for this, no matter your party, you can vote for this law. So, again, it's not a Republican or Democratic issue for Marcy's Law specifically, but for anybody on the ballot, you can vote whatever way you want in the general election. Now, we do have closed elections for the primaries, and that's been sort of a point of contention in our legislature before. People have wanted to open that up so that independents or people who belong to third parties can vote in those elections. But as of now, no clear consensus on that in our legislature. But Thank you so much for your call. And now, Doug and Emily. Emily, I want to get into that one provision in this law that says you can't vote by pressing one button anymore, automatic straight ticket voting. That was something that got a lot of Democrats, specifically progressive Democrats, a little bit out of shape. They were not really pleased that this amendment or this provision got in there. What does it do, and why were they upset, and who was upset?
So basically, as you said, many Democrats want straight ticket voting. They did not want it eliminated, and the biggest reason seems to be that getting rid of it could make voting take longer and then possibly disenfranchise people who might not have time to wait longer on election day. And some proponents who did want it eliminated have countered that by saying, you know, polling places are really crowded on election day. There could be pressure on people to vote straight ticket to get through faster, even if they wouldn't otherwise do that. Also, that expanding mail-in ballots might cut down on crowds at the polls and compensate for the extra time people might take out to fill out their ballot, fill out their ballot without the straight ticket option. And I would also note that, like, my own analysis of certain races in the past, turnout and ballot cuts and things like that, does indicate that there's split ticket voting. It definitely goes on in Pennsylvania, even higher up on the ticket. So
yeah.
Just wanted to note that.
Yeah, so split ticket voting, pretty obvious term, but if anybody doesn't know, it's when, you know, you vote for instance, the Democrat at the top of the ticket, but then you vote for Republicans farther down or vice versa. You're voting, you know, not by party. So there was a lot of debate, can't stress this enough, on straight ticket voting on the floor. And this actually, this came up before as well. Governor Tom Wolf vetoed another election package several months ago because it included this provision that got rid of straight ticket voting. So, Emily, he's changed course on this. Do we have any sense of why?
Well, the official word on that is he wanted, you know, he saw this as a compromise to get a lot of other stuff done. One of the things that was new, and at the time I believe you were covering this more closely than me, but, you know, there was the money to bolster census response rates. That's another thing this bill does that it didn't before, right? So that's an important thing to note. That's something that he's, you know, getting that was not in a similar bill that was vetoed over the summer. And so basically, Pennsylvania hadn't appropriated money to help fund initiatives that are meant to bolster response rates to the census. That's important because we want to have accurate information about our population, but also it's really key to getting federal money. So nothing was budgeted before, and that's not necessarily typical. So if you look at neighboring states like New Jersey, it has $9 million budgeted, $20 million in New York, but on top of the $40 million that New York City itself is going to spend, Maryland's spending like $900,000. But there wasn't any money for Pennsylvania at all in the budget or in the old bill that Wolf had vetoed. But this one, that's now our 77, it includes $4 million for census outreach. But we don't know. I don't have details on how that's going to be spent yet. I don't know if Doug has more information.
Well, Doug, you wanted to weigh in on this, right?
Sure. Yeah, on the question on the compromise.
Sure.
The other thing that was not in the bill the governor vetoed was the change in the registration date.
Right.
And the governor, of course, is a proponent of same-day registration. Candidly, Pennsylvania is not quite ready for that. We have significant security concerns about whether we could handle that well. And so the 15 days was a compromise, but that was something that got closer to his agenda. The other point I'll mention, too, about straight party voting is that the point people miss is if you vote straight party, it doesn't vote you on things like the constitutional amendment or the judicial retention elections that are also part of the ballot. And so we have pieces that people end up not voting for if they just walk in, push the straight party button, and walk out. And
right.
So that is also, we think, going to improve public understanding of everything that's available to be voted on.
Yeah. Emily, I want to ask you just a quick question to contextualize everything. These changes to Pennsylvania's election laws, Were we, before these changes were made and now they're going to be put into effect, were we kind of out of step with what most states were doing? Did most states have, for instance, more lenient absentee ballot registrations and more lenient registration deadlines?
We were about in line with other states when it comes to absentee ballot windows, so like when they could possibly start mailing them out. That's now, we're one of the longest, but mm-hmm. as you know, that wasn't always like how it worked out in practical terms, and a lot of you know, the turnaround for absentee ballots was a subject of, and that's as far as it's the latest that you could apply for one.
Right.
The turnaround to receive it, send it back. The ACLU, which brought the lawsuit relating to that sort of late absentee request turnaround issue, they say that they feel that this bill addresses their concerns, the concerns that are in that lawsuit. But as far as the maximum window goes, when you can start requesting and get the ballot to when you can send it back, that was already in line with other states, 45 days, and that's a pretty minimum, and that's pretty pretty popular window. But now, with the extra days, we are one of the longest, and some years we are the longest without, you know, requiring an excuse, for example.
Without requiring what? I'm sorry?
An excuse.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. And yeah, Doug, anything you can add to that? I'm assuming the county, what the elections administrators in different states talk to each other a little bit mm-hmm. about this stuff.
Yeah, and we are, as Emily says, relatively comparable to the other states. But we are appreciative of the fact that the legislation settled the later turn-in on mm-hmm. the absentee ballots. As she said, it was under litigation. We would much prefer a legislative solution to a judicial one.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And we're going to take a couple of calls here. I think they also might be about Marcy's Law, but we'll wait and see. This one is from Kathy in York County. Kathy, how's it going today?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for taking it.
So what's
I wanted to know, what role can independent voters play in the election today?
Good question. A normal one. Independent voters can pretty much vote normally. There's not anything that differentiates an independent from a person who's registered with a major party on a general election day. Is that pretty much the case, Doug?
That's correct. Everyone who's a registered voter is eligible to vote for everything on the ballot today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, in primaries, that's not the case. In primaries, things can be pretty different for independents. You know, if there's not a candidate on the ballot that is of your party, you can't vote for them.
Right. Although I'll clarify, an independent can still vote during a primary election if there's a ballot question up.
Yes.
They just can't vote for the party candidates.
Yeah, that's a good point of clarification. Kathy, thank you. We're also going to take a call from Evelyn in Perry County. Evelyn, what's on your mind?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to give notice to voters today that on the League of Women Voters site, they have a very good summary of what Marcy's Law is about and its pros and cons. And this, I'm sure this is confusing for people because they hear victims' rights, and yes, that's what we want. But it also details what would happen in our courts and how defendants would be affected by this. And I think we have to think also from the perspective of a defendant because we never know when we may be accused of a crime. And this, when a person becomes a defendant in a trial, it is the state that is doing the prosecution and not the victim. Mm-hmm. So we need to keep that in mind. Also, in 1998, Pennsylvania passed the Crime Victims Act, and this gives victims many rights. And the League has that also detailed on this website. So they can go to palwv.org and click on issues. And this will come up, and they can see exactly what Marcy's Law would do and the pros and cons of it.
All right.
If I may, I'd like also to remind voters, and especially women voters, that in 1920, women were given the right to vote. It will be 100 years next year that we women have had the right to vote. So I urge all of you, get out and vote. Enforce that right. This is a democracy, and we have to vote.
All right. Evelyn, thanks so much for your call. And it sounds like Evelyn might be potentially against Marcy's law or questioning it. I should note the League of Women Voters, who has that PSA on their website, they were a party in the case. The American Civil Liberties Union brought the lawsuit against Marcy's law on behalf of the League of Women Voters and an individual plaintiff. So just, again, to contextualize what everyone's perspective is here, but, you know, read everything you can about that amendment. We also have explainers and ongoing coverage of that on PA Post and WITF.org. So I'd also urge you to go there for sort of a full look at it. And Doug, did you have something on that?
Yeah. First, I'll emphasize our association does not have a position on the law,
sure,
but we are administering the election. And I think a lot of voters have some confusion based on all the developments in the court, whether it's on the ballot or not. It is on the ballot. Mm-hmm. If you have an interest in it, you should still turn out for the election. You should still vote one way or another. The only thing that is open at this point is whether the courts are going to allow it to be counted afterward. But if you have an interest, yes, please get out and please vote.
All right. That's the word on that. We're going to take a quick break. Thank you for listening to Smart Talk. And we will be back after the break with some more discussions on voting machines. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We have Doug Hill, who is the executive director of the County Commissioners Association. What's the full title of that? I always forget it.
County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania.
All right. And we're talking about elections with Doug today. Emily Previty of PA Post is also on the line. And now we're just going to have a brief discussion about another big change that's been going on in the last couple of years at this point in Pennsylvania. It's voting machines. So, Doug, let's start with you. I think it really was 2017, maybe late 2017. At this point, Governor Wolf said that he wanted all of the counties to update their voting machines. And this was after, for instance, the state was sued by Jill Stein's presidential campaign after the 2016 election. She said that the machines might be vulnerable to tampering. So counties, I think, raised a lot of furor in the beginning because it wasn't clear if there was going to be money to help them pay for these machines.
Sure.
And they are very expensive. So where does all of that stand right now? There's been a lot of progress here.
Sure. Yeah. Yes. Well, what you're referring to, there's a settlement agreement with the Jill Stein campaign that actually requires all of our counties to replace their equipment by the April 2020 primary. And it's in part a security issue, but really more of an audit issue because our current equipment, by and large, is what's called direct recording electronics. So it essentially is recorded on a computer rather than on a piece of paper. And the Stein settlement requires us to have a paper-based system in place, whether it's machine-marked or hand-marked by the voter. And so we will have new audit requirements in place, and we hope gives voters better confidence. But yes, the cost for doing the replacement is initially estimated about $150 million. Counties, absent that, but still facing the deadline, have been diligent in working on their replacements. We had, I think, 8 or 9 counties that had new equipment in place for the spring primary. We have another 30-some going online for today's election, and then the remainder will be in place for April 2020. All of them will be paper-based systems, whether machine-marked or hand-marked. We'll have some additional audit requirements, something called a risk-limiting audit. We can get into that technicality if you really want.
We'll see.
But the bottom line is to give the voters better confidence and to provide some audit capabilities that we don't currently have.
Gotcha. And so when a county updates its voting machines, what sort of a process is that like on the ground? I'm assuming a lot of testing has to be done. There's some unknowns, perhaps, about how a system's going to work.
Well, first, we have to select from the available systems that are certified at both the federal and state levels. And these are rigorous certifications on the ability of the equipment to handle the election, on the security provisions. And in fact, in Pennsylvania, they even go deeply into the software that supports the system itself. Mm-hmm. And then counties make a selection from among those choices. Now, we had a great working relationship with the Pennsylvania Department of State. All of the available equipment was put on state contract, which expedites the procurement process for us and also reduces the price from what the list cost might be. And I'm also pleased to say that all of the counties have been diligent further in their procurement processes and trying to drive the price down further. So the initial estimate of $150 million is actually going to come, we're actually going to come in a good bit lower than that, we believe.
Okay. And so you don't know exactly how much counties are going to be on the hook for at the end of the day, though?
At the end of the day, we're guessing it's going to be in the range of $110 to $120 million.
Mm-hmm. Per county or for
no,
everybody?
No, statewide.
Okay, I was going to say, statewide. That's a lot. Okay. And so, Emily, I want to go to you now because there was a lot of back and forth in the legislature about whether the state was going to put in money for the counties. They ended up doing it. And how much it was going to be. It ended up being, I believe, $90 million. And also, like, what the requirements should be for counties to pick these things and to pick the companies that they're going to use for the voting machines. So you've been covering that in some depth. What have the main things that you've been looking at been?
So we had looked at provisions and contracts to cover some of the longer-term costs versus upfront costs for software, security patches and updates and upgrades. I would note that if we're going to talk about, you know, how much it's cost so far, those can tack on, you know, so far based on the contracts that have been finalized, can add another 50% or a third or 20% over 5 to 10 years to the upfront costs. And those, in most cases, would not be eligible for reimbursement by the state.
Okay.
So far, go ahead.
Oh, I just said okay.
And so we've been looking at that. We've been looking at what method they've selected. You know, many counties are opting for ballots that are filled out by hand and then scanned by a machine versus the touchscreen direct electronic recording machines that were the dominant choice among Pennsylvania counties previously.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a big change. There are about 36 counties reviewing election systems today and another 10 or so that had already done it before today. So of those 20 or so that have not rolled out their new systems yet, 10 of them have already executed their contracts or are well into the negotiation process.
Gotcha. And Emily, you have been covering this, as I said, in some depth. You're actually out covering this issue today. Where are you right now?
I am in Mercer County, and I apologize. I guess the landline that I'm using hasn't been the best.
That's okay.
I'm in Mercer County. They are debuting a new election system today, going from touchscreen DREs to ballots that are filled out by hand and then scanned. And Mercer is also one of two counties where the Department of State is going to develop a new and different, more rigorous auditing process, post-election auditing process than the one that's already in place. And that'll be, again, a couple weeks after the election. And so Mercer will actually go first, and then Philly will follow at the end of that same week. So we figured we'd be here for the audit, probably be here for the actual election, you know, at PA Post, we try to hit all the different corners of the state strategically. PA Post Ed Mann is in Northampton today, where the county's rolling out the Express Vote XL, the source of some controversy.
Okay.
As far as voting machine selection.
Why has that been controversial?
So the XL was the subject of a petition challenge by some, you know, fair election watchdog groups that, you know, they filed this challenge over the summer, identified 10 issues with the machine. The Department of State responded, addressing 3 of the issues, but upholding their certification with some new qualifications. And the manner in which that re-examination by the state was done prompted criticism because there wasn't the normal public access to the proceedings. The state said there were too many security issues. There was also the requirement in the lawsuit settlement by in that lawsuit that we got into before, you know, that you mentioned that was filed by the Green Party presidential candidate in 2016, Jill Stein. Separate group of plaintiffs, but they said, hey, you know, we feel that the Express Vote the certification of it and the implementation of it would violate our settlement agreement, as does the manner in which the reexamination was undertaken by the state, including but not limited to the fact that they were supposed to, they should have, according to the plaintiff, alerted them that that was happening, and the state didn't, again, citing security issues. But so now the plaintiff in the lawsuit that is leading to this replacement of voting machines across Pennsylvania are looking at the XL and pointing to that and saying, we might want to try to reopen this case and get the judge to enforce the settlement and have the machines certified.
Gotcha. Emily, I want to sort of zoom out big picture real quick, because I think, voting machines, it can get really technical. But fundamentally, the reason that you've been looking into this so closely is that it is a very big part of our electoral process. You know, the technology that we use to cast votes can make a big difference in how votes are tabulated. And sometimes if something goes wrong, whether they're tabulated correctly. And we should also note that, the companies that provide these voting machines, it's a business. They're in it to hopefully, on their end, make money. And so they have a vested interest in selling these things to states. So I'm curious for you, what are the big, big picture issues that you're concerned about when you go out to report on this issue, when you look at a voting machine in a county, when you talk to voters who are trying to use them? What are you looking at?
Well, whether they were confused at all by the process, if it's new for them, that's something that we would ask. Also, if the voter needed to cancel the ballot and get a new one, how streamlined is that process? The reason being that on election day, if it's too cumbersome, that could cause some delays. The other issue that comes up with the XL, and this gets back into the petition, but is also an issue sort of across the voting machine industry, if you will, using barcodes on paper ballots. So can you verify that a barcode matches, that it's indicative of the ballot you intended to cast? I personally could not look at a barcode and say, yes, that means that I voted for Katie Meyer for treasurer or
you
whatever.
You better vote for me for treasurer.
Pardon?
You better vote for me for treasurer. I'm a write-in.
Always.
Yeah.
So those are the types of things that we would be looking for, and then any troubleshooting that might occur, or the processes the counties are using to keep ballots secure, particularly in those that didn't have to worry about that before. So if they're transporting ballots back to the central office for scanning, how does that work, and things along those lines.
Okay. And Doug, I'll kind of turn that same question to you. You've been doing this for a little while. You're reaching the end of your tenure here at the in the elections game and for the county commissioners. Is that right?
Yes. Retiring at the end of the year after 35 years with the association.
Well, congratulations. And in those years, what are the things that you focus on? What are sort of the principles, I think, guiding this whole effort of making sure that elections work properly on the county level?
The counties are very much concerned with the security of the system from front to back. And that's a year-round thing. It's how we store the equipment, how we do the programming, how we do all the preparation, and then how we carry the equipment out, secure it on site, and then how we return the voted ballots back to the county and security from there on out. And we're confident that counties are exercising all the possible diligence they can in the entirety of the system. I think one thing, too, I'll address the point of the barcodes. Because this is a paper-based system, the return that the voter gets from the machine also lists the candidates that they voted for. So they will see that visibly on that piece of paper that has the barcode. The barcode is what we'll use as part of the scanning system to do the count. But if there's a challenge on that particular race, either we can do the rescan or, if necessary, on a recount, we can actually hand count based on what we see of the voter's intent. I think the other point, too, is that the risk-limiting audits, the stepped-up audit requirements that we're going through, are also going to be examining those even without a challenge. And so that should also increase the confidence that we have that the barcode is accurately reflecting what the voter's intent.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to leave this conversation there for today. But if anybody didn't get this point yet, today's election day. Go on out and vote. Everyone, including independents, can do so and should do so. This is a democracy. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Katie Meyer. Welcome back to Smart Talk. On November 6th, i.e. tomorrow, to help fight hunger in central Pennsylvania, for every dollar you give to WITF, Giant Food Stores will donate 1 pound of food to the Central Pennsylvania Food Bank, up to 50,000 pounds. Every gift makes a difference, so thank you for your contributions. All right. On this, our third segment, we're going to switch gears and talk about a group of bills that have been introduced in the legislature in an effort to, in a way, equalize menstruation. You may ask what that means. So joining me to explain the effort are lawmakers who are sponsoring two of the four bills in the package, Senator Maria Collette of Bucks County and Representative Danielle Frill-Otten of Chester County. We welcome your questions and comments on this. Call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. And again, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. All right, so on this package of bill, Senator Collette, let me start with you. Can you just explain the package broadly? What does it do? What are the little components in there?
Sure. Good morning. It's
good morning.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
So the bill that I've introduced in the Senate is a companion bill to the House bills that I'm sure Representative Frill-Otten will talk about. The bill I introduced is called the Pennsylvania Menstrual Equity Act. And it would require agencies that serve the young, low-income, homeless, incarcerated to offer menstrual products in their public restroom facilities at no cost, just as they do with other basic health and hygiene products like toilet paper, soap, paper towels, those things.
Okay. And, yeah, Representative Frill-Otten, and there are, I think, three other bills in the House as well?
Yes. So there are three bills in the House. One, the bill that I sponsored is called Lily's Bill. It's deals with public schools from grades 6 through 12. Lily came to me in my office to talk to me about how in her schools they don't have menstrual hygiene products in their bathrooms. And when she went to talk to the school board about it, the school board refused to stock them. So, she brought me some legislation from other states where they are working to create more equity for young women. And I thought it was a great way to partner with a young woman and empower her to make a difference in her own community. And then we have two other bills. One is for dignity for incarcerated women, and that's Representative Isabella Fitzgerald has introduced that. And that requires for correctional facilities to provide menstrual hygiene products at no cost. And then the other bill is Rep. Sarah Inamorato's bill that deals with higher education. So the bills in all of our state-funded colleges would be required as well.
Gotcha. And so this is sort of a way, Senator Collette, it seems like you guys, with these four bills, you're trying to cover most of the bases in terms of requiring menstrual products to be available in public places. So places that get funding by the state, for instance. First of all, is that the goal? And second of all, you know, why was this something that you wanted to take on?
Sure. So you're absolutely right. That is the goal. It's to make sure that these products are accessible, easy to get to, and that, menstruating individuals are able to access them. And this really came about because when we started talking about period poverty and the inability to afford these products and what that impact is on women that, need to have these products as a general hygiene product, then we were really talking about the inability to access. And so we sat down and we started to look at the bill that's before Congress now. That's Congresswoman Meng's bill, H.R. 1882. And we said, how can we craft this at the state level so that we are covering the bases here, so that young women, just as Representative Frill-Otten talked about, women in our high schools and, when they're trying to, make sure that they're getting to class on time, they're carrying their books and, they're trying to go in between class time and their locker and all of those things. How can they make sure they have access to these products so that they're just able to maintain basic hygiene? We're not talking about anything other than that here. It's the same as when you go into a restroom and you expect toilet paper to be there, it's there.
Mm-hmm. And on this idea of menstrual product equity, some other states have been trying to grapple with something people, I think, colloquially call the pink tax. And it's not just for menstrual products, but in this case, it is a tax on menstrual products. Now, Pennsylvania does not have that, right?
No, Pennsylvania does not tax menstrual hygiene products. But the pink tax does exist because just yesterday I bought T-shirts for my kids, and the T-shirts for my daughter were $1 more than the ones for my son. And
oh,
I was
gosh.
Like, wow! I even see the pink tax at a very young age. So,
interesting. So Pennsylvania, no tax on menstrual products. But I think you guys had kind of cast this as a next step. Is that sort of the case, Senator Collette?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. We did away with that tax, you know, nearly 30 years ago because we realized these products are necessities. And so you're right. This is just going that one step further. I have to say that in the conversations I've had about this, when I talk to people about going into the restroom and expecting toilet paper, soap for washing your hands, paper towels for drying your hands, and I liken it to that, people go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Aren't we doing that already? And I have to say, no, we're not, but we can be. And so that's really the point here, making sure that we're normalizing this conversation. It's not something that is, you know, beyond the pale. It's not something that we should all be like, oh, my gosh, this is outrageous. Why are we providing these products? We're doing it just, you know, the way that we do other hygiene products in a public restroom.
Well, and I want to dig into that a little. Oh, go ahead, Representative Freelaten.
I'm sorry. Just
no worries.
To add in there that I think one of the other things that we haven't really talked about with this issue is that when I was a young teenager in schools, the menstrual hygiene machines were always filled. And as school funding over the years from the state and our districts are having to make do with more with less, that has changed. So it hasn't always been this way.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't always been that these products were not available. It's just something, these are the corners that get cut as we squeeze education funding, when it comes to the schools at least. Because I remember when I was a young student, these products were available in restrooms. And so the fact that they're not now, I think it's something that that over the years of school funding has really taken a squeeze. These are the corners that get cut, the corners that affect our girls and their hygiene and their wellness.
Yeah, well, and to back up what you just said, I think many people listening may not use menstrual products, so this is a little bit of an FYI. But that is the case, you know, what you just described, where you go into a bathroom, you check one of the little machines, and they are empty. And it often is the case that they're empty. So it's not an uncommon situation that you've just described.
Right.
Now, I want to ask, so this is a relatively new package of legislation. I don't think any of these bills have moved yet. Who have you heard support from?
Well, in the Senate, you know, I have over 20 co-sponsors from both sides of the aisle, men and women. We're hearing a lot of support. I think the truth of it is that in order to make sure that this bill or these package of bills move, we really do have to, as you said, appeal to the people that don't think about this as a daily subject, people that aren't menstruating. But what we need to remind them is that they have daughters, wives, sisters, people around them menstruating all the time. And so this is not abnormal. It is not something that we shouldn't be comfortable talking about. It is basic hygiene. Before I came to the legislature, I was a nurse. I feel very comfortable talking about this, but I know it's a barrier. I know we have to get over that and talk about it. And I think the more we bring this to light, the more we talk to our colleagues about it, the more we talk about this as a hygiene and dignity issue and a productivity issue, frankly, then we can really get people on board. We can really get people to understand this. I want to make one point, too, terms of cost, because one of the things I hear about is, oh, my goodness, what's the cost of this going to be? We researched, and in 2018, DGS, the General Services Budget, we had them run a report for janitorial paper products. It amounted to 0.0005% of the state general fund budget. So we're talking about an absolute drop in an Olympic-sized pool here in terms of money to go for this, and it's really important and it's necessary.
Yeah, well, and I wanted to dig in a little bit more on that because you had mentioned before the requirement that public restrooms provide paper products, so toilet paper, paper towels if you use them, if you don't have electric hand dryers. That is in state law, right? It's been in there for a very long time. I actually had to go and look
this
up.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So essentially what you guys are asking is that tampons, pads, menstrual products are treated in a similar way to, for instance, toilet paper?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's it.
And so now you mentioned some of the feedback you've gotten. You mentioned costs, Senator Collette. What other opposition have you guys been hearing?
Well, I've heard from people that have, said, basically, it's sort of this notion, and again, it goes back to not being comfortable talking about this issue. It goes back to, I can take care of myself, and I don't need the government to provide these products for me, that kind of thing. And it's really sort of not thinking about that broader picture and thinking about those populations of women who aren't able to afford or access these products and really the impact of this on them. When I need menstrual products and I go to the grocery store and pay $8 or $9 for a box of tampons, it doesn't affect my budget, but there are people for whom this is considered a luxury item that they have to decide between putting food on their table and buying menstrual products, and it affects every aspect of their lives in that time period. So we need to really be very careful about how we talk about these products and about how we talk about the necessity for them and how we talk about the impact this has on society as a whole when we just make this a normal conversation instead of making it an outlier, making it something that only certain people are concerned about or talk about.
Mm-hmm. And you guys had a little press conference, I think it was a week or two ago now, and we had a bunch of speakers who talked about this, about how they've experienced, as you said, I think the term you were using was period poverty. Are there any stories? I know Representative Friola, and you mentioned Lily, the student who reached out to mm-hmm. you about this. Any other stories in this vein that have stuck with you guys?
Yeah, I mean, just as I've started to dig into this issue more, I've just heard so much about young women who are using gloves and socks from the lost and found bin at their school or at their church, and newspaper, and just that level of inability to have access to the basic hygiene needs that you have, to me, is just astounding. And every time I hear these stories, it just makes me more committed to this conversation, because there's no reason that any person should feel the need to, go scrounging through a box of lost and found, items to see what they can do to meet their basic hygiene needs. I said to someone the other day, menstruation is a bodily function just like urination, defecation. All three are the same. And so, and when you say it that way, people are like, you're right, it is. And so there should be access to the things you need for your basic hygiene when you go into a public restroom. That's just the bottom line. The law that codified toilet paper, hand towels, soap, that was in 1929. And if we think back to 1929 and, where girls and women were in our society, it wasn't determined at that time that menstrual hygiene products were a necessity. And that's been a lot of the pushback that I've gotten, is that, this was codified and this was not determined to be a necessity. But menstrual hygiene products were very different in the 20s. And women also had a much different role in our society and education and the workforce. And so, I think that we can't really use 1929 as the basis for this conversation. We really need to bring our women and girls and people who are menstruating up to our current position in society and make sure that everybody has equitable access to the things that they need.
Yeah.
And I hear all the time, women have been dealing with this issue for centuries. You're right, they have, by staying home. And we don't want our girls to stay home.
Mm-hmm. And we have about 30 seconds left. I want to ask either one of you, what are the prospects you see for this bill? You said it has some bipartisan co-sponsors. Have you heard anything from leaders about whether this is going to move?
Well,
Go ahead.
I was going to say in the Senate, I haven't heard that, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to continue those conversations and keep pushing.
All right. And Representative Freelaton?
We met with Representative Sonny, the chair of education, on the day of the rally.
Right.
He wants to see us get more support at the local level. We are going to keep pushing to make sure that he brings this
All
to the
right.
conversation.
Thank you so much. And thanks for being part of today's conversation on Smart Talk. It's available through NPR One on your computer or smartphone and wherever you listen to podcasts. You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Katie Meyer.